Some of us have drive, and some of us are beyond driven. Welcome to Beyond Driven Radio, bodybuilding's first stand. What's up, everybody? This is David Johnson, and welcome to another episode of Beyond Driven Radio. After the holidays, here with my co-host, Mr. Scott McNally. Scott, how you doing?
Hey, what's up, DJ? How you been, man?
Cold, man. It is.
You just virtual. Called him DJ.
That's our special silent guest, Shelby Starnes. We're going to introduce him. And our special guest for the night, Mr. Shelby Starnes. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Like I said, cold but good. It is freezing, yeah. And there's snow piled up to our windows on our cars here in Rhode Island. So,
but Shelby, I did say DJ, and that way I only have to change like one vowel, you know, for different podcasts. Oh. Yeah,
as opposed to VJ. Yeah,
yeah, as opposed to VJ.
Nice,
right.
Nice and simple for you.
Yeah.
So, as I let the cat out of the bag, Mr. Shelby Starnes, prep coach extraordinaire, is our guest for this evening, yes. And I reached out about a week ago to Shelby, pitching some different ideas, what I want to talk about tonight. And it was actually Shelby's idea. I thought it was an excellent idea, kind of talking about the psychology of the competitor. And, you know, that's a great way to just jump right into the fire. Shelby, you know, you've done probably more podcasts than me and Scott combined. With that, everybody, I think, is familiar that, you know, you studied psychology. What was your personal draw to psychology specifically, and was that part of the reason that you kind of easily segued into prep coaching?
You know, I think it might be a genetic thing. Both of my parents have a strong interest in psychology. That's not what either of them do, but they both have a strong interest there. I never in my life said I want to be a psychologist or a psychiatrist. That's just what I ended up studying the most in school. I changed majors a lot. When I first started going to school, I majored in art education. I thought maybe I want to be an art teacher. Hmm. And then years later, I never went to school. I was always working full time at the same time, so it took me a long time to get a degree. Later on, I changed my major to business. And then finally, I just got to the point where it's like, I need to get a degree soon. And most of the classes I've been taking are psychology classes. That's what interests me the most. So that's what I'll finish up and wrap it up. So I guess more broadly,
was it just kind of, I mean, like, my degree's in philosophy, but I always had a really strong interest in psychology as well. And for me, it was just, I never fit into that, I hate to say it, but quote unquote normal mold. You know, my parents were old hippies, and I grew up in some really suburban community where the other parents were doctors and lawyers and, you know, business professionals. And I, you know, my dad had long hair. I started growing my hair out when I was really young, just kind of trying to get into, I don't want to say understood people, but the stuff that motivated regular people, quote unquote, normal people, just was never much of a motivator to me. Did you have kind of that same affinity where you just looked out at the masses and said, all right, I'm going to observe this and take some notes and kind of try to see what's driving, common interest, so to speak?
I don't know if I would say it was like that. I think it just always came down to the human mind, the brain, whatever, however you want to look at it, was always just the coolest thing for me to learn about and study. And I don't think it went any deeper than that.
Okay. Was there a specific field of psychology that really called to you?
Well, as I got more into it, I was drawn more to cognitive psychology, which is, you know, more the actual functioning of the brain. A lot of people, when you say, oh, I went to psychology, they think like all you studied was Freud and Jung, and you want to put people on a couch and you know their motives behind everything. And that's not what psychology is. You know, I mean, psychology is a massive, massive field that encompasses many things. Right. And I was kind of drawn more to cognitive psychology. I was really interested in language and how the mind works, how the mind processes and creates language. I took some graduate classes in linguistics. I was considering going to graduate school for cognitive psychology, but I always found myself like if you're going to go to graduate school for something, you have to be like a real extreme diehard.
Yeah.
Sure.
Because I mean, it's like you have to live on like $1,000 a month stipend, and you know, be a teacher's assistant and do that for years, and it's like, I mean, you have to be a religious devotee to whatever it is you're studying. And I said, I'm not that into it. I was very drawn to bodybuilding. I always found myself doing my homework and I'd be like, man, I can't wait to finish this homework so I can go do something, you know, read about bodybuilding or whatever. So,
all right.
And so, so much of graduate work too. I mean, not to get off on a tangent, but so much of graduate work is just such bullshit. Like there's just so much minutia that you have to study. Nuts. It's like,
I was going
to
say, are you talking the minutia portion? Cause that's kind of what motivated me. You know, I did really well as an undergrad, and then looking at a PhD program, you know, you have to go back and read the original texts in Latin and Greek, and you know, you're becoming such a specialist.
It's so, it's like a waste of time. <It's> like, what is that accomplishing? Like, really?
Well, unless you're trying to really, you know, work in a laboratory and actually, you know, do research for the next generation. So let's take that then, since you were so interested in bodybuilding, what would you characterize, huge broad question, but what would you characterize as the psychology of a good physique competitor? What personality traits, behaviors, et cetera, seem to lend themselves most to excelling at bodybuilding generally, and more specifically, competing?
Well, I think bodybuilding in general can draw people from all walks and all personalities, but the people that are going to excel in it, and I guess we'll just say competitors because that's, you know, kind of a logical step or whatever, is going to be someone with a type A personality. You know, someone that just doesn't make any excuses, very detail-oriented, very regimented, likes having a schedule, you know, OCD about things. Anybody that's really type A is going to rise to the top, regardless of their genetics. You know, they're going to, they're not going to take any excuses.
Have you seen people that had not a type A personality be able to kind of change and morph into good competitors?
Not really.
They just struggle and struggle.
Yeah. I mean, maybe they'll have moderate success at a low level, but like, I mean, to really climb the ranks and keep going, you've got to be type A. And type A makes up for a whole bunch of genetic misgivings or whatever. You know, I mean, there's tons of people, especially nowadays with the proliferation of pro cards, people that are doing well, that really don't have the best genetics to begin with, but it's like a war of attrition. They had the mental capacity, the type A personality, and maybe the financial means to keep going when others couldn't.
So essentially the quote unquote outworking the competition, they didn't have the natural God given gifts, but they put in the hours.
Right. Now, of course, when you get to the very, very top, it's going to be the people that are genetic freaks.
Right.
But they're also the hardest workers. You know, I mean, you're weeding out all these, lesser people, so to speak, lesser bodybuilders. Another trait would be risk tolerant as opposed to risk averse.
That's actually a really good point. I had the epiphany one day while doing a dumbbell shoulder press and kicking like 110 pound dumbbells over my head. Like, you know, bodybuilding is kind of about seeing how crazy you can be without officially stepping over the edge. Like, how much are you willing to push without going into the wild blue yonder and not coming back. So absolutely with a risk aversion. And, you know, we're not even talking supplements or anything like that. Even the training itself. I mean, how far can you push the failure without getting hurt?
Right. I heard someone say recently, the dumber you are, the farther you can go. And I think that's taking a little bit too far, but I understand where they're going with that.
Well, turning off that rational side of your mind that tells you, no, don't jump out of the airplane, even if there's a backpack, like it's a bad idea. Right. Kind of quieting that voice in your head that tells you at times, maybe this isn't a great idea. So it's not stupidity, but, you know, mm-hmm. the ability to quote unquote be brave, if you will.
Yeah.
So do you think in order to be a good competitor, you have to have something of a chip on your shoulder, something to prove, whether to yourself or others? You know, that's not necessarily synonymous with being type A, but obviously a lot of type A individuals do have that chip on their shoulder.
I guess I would want to define what chip on your shoulder means, because that's chip on your shoulder can mean different things to different people, and it can have different, I guess, varying degrees of intensity. Sure. I think everyone's always got something to prove to themselves. You know, I don't think anyone's going to do bodybuilding if they're not trying to prove something to themselves, not necessarily others. But I'm not sure that any like negative reasons, you know, if you're just competing and your sole mission is to prove so-and-so wrong that you can do that, I'm not sure that that's very conducive to like a long, healthy career. I don't really see that as a positive motivator. I think it can work in the short term. It can help motivate a workout or help you get through, you know, some really shitty days of dieting or whatever. But if you're trying to say, hey, I'm going to build my career on this chip on my shoulder, I don't think that's necessarily a good way of doing it.
Well, at least for me personally, I'd be interested to hear your take on this. Like, I found through the years, in the beginning, there was more of that. And obviously with age, you know, you get a little tamer and you get a little more laid back and hopefully a little more, I don't want to say positive, but, you know, not feeling compelled to go out and prove to the world everything that you can do. Have you seen that as a general trend with the competitors that you prep, that when they're younger, they maybe have a little more to prove to the world, and then as they age, less proving it to the world, more an internal journey, you know, just doing it for their own satisfaction, so to speak?
Yeah, I think that's fairly common, and I think that's just a general, you know, maturity of the competitor, having more experience as a competitor. And I think, you know, bodybuilding is just a microcosm of everything else that goes on in life and that humans endeavor with. There's nothing really that's just specific to bodybuilding. You know, everything that you can learn about and take away from bodybuilding, you can find in other facets of life, you know, life development and whatnot. And I think that's just true of, you know, if you just found a 20-year-old adult or a 25-year-old adult, yeah, they've got something to prove. And they're, I mean, generally speaking, sure, it's a different mindset from a 35 or 40-year-old or a 45 or 50-year-old. You know, I mean, that's just how life works.
Well, and kind of by necessity, because at the age of 25, you have to go out and kind of stake your claim, so to speak. Whereas hopefully by the age of 45, your claim has been staked. If not, you know, you kind of miss the timeline, so to speak. It's not to say you can't progress at that point, but I understand exactly what you're saying. You got to start out a little more hungry when you're younger, and then hopefully you get your belly full and you're not as hungry.
And it's also the timeline of the competitor, because you can have a competitor that doesn't start competing until they're in their 40s, and they're going to have that same mindset of the 20-year-old.
Do you actually find that? It's actually really interesting. Sometimes. I was going to say, when you have a 20-year-old come to you versus a 40-year-old come to you, what's the general difference in demeanor in terms of motivations and kind of where their head is at for why they want to do this?
It's so individual. I mean, you can make generalizations, but I mean, it just, a lot of it comes down to their IQ. Right?
Sure. No, absolutely. Do you find
some people are smart and have a good grasp of things early on and other people aren't. And it's not necessarily just an IQ thing. I mean, sometimes it's, you know, personality and risk tolerance and all that. Sure. But I think you know where I'm going with that.
Sure. So obviously, you know, as most people age, they get, you know, a little more comfortable with being comfortable, if that makes sense. Whereas when you're young, you know, you're young and dumb and willing to endure whatever bullshit gets thrown your way a lot of the time. Do you find with your older competitors, they have more of an aversion towards kind of living in that pain state or that miserable state during the home stretch of prep that lasts, you know, 8 weeks when you're just not going to feel great? Is it more difficult in your experience with individuals who start later than those who start earlier? Or again, this is all over the board.
I've never experienced that. Honestly, if anything, it's the other way around. It's the younger people that can't handle it. And I don't know if that's a generational thing, you know, millennials versus, you know, Gen X or baby boomers or whatever. But if anything, I think the older people have been through some tough shit in their life. And especially if they're competitors, they already know how tough dieting can be. And so they know what to expect. They know what to expect. Whereas a young person, I mean, if they're 20, they might be really soft and have never done anything hard in their life.
Sure.
And then all of a sudden you got to starve them, whatever. And it's like, holy shit, I've never felt this type of pain or sacrifice or whatever. So I think it's the other way around. If you're going to generalize.
And I think that's interesting, only because, you know, I don't want to turn this into another rant about social media or the millennial era or any of that crap. But, you know, we're seeing all these stats, like this is the first generation where kids are having sex later than the previous generation. They're not, you know, smoking as much pot as the previous generation. Like, it's the first generation we've seen where they're doing stuff much later. I want to say almost more timid than the, you know, previous several generations. Are you noticing with younger people who are reaching out to you that it's just different than it was 10 years ago? 20-year-olds now versus 20-year-olds 10 years ago, are you seeing kind of a different psychology based on how the world's changed in the last 10 years with social media and the internet and all that?
I'm not sure I have a good enough sample to draw on to give a good answer there, because for whatever reason or reasons, I seem to attract older people, usually older, more mature competitors. I think usually the younger people are more attracted to other coaches for a variety of reasons. So I don't, at least nowadays, I don't really have a good sample to draw from to make that a statement on something like that.
So you're answering all these questions about the young kids, and you don't train any young kids is what you're telling us. So we're not supposed to listen.
I've trained some, and I'm just, you know, over the years, but I don't, I mean, it's all speculation.
I understand what you're saying, though. You're not throwing a ton of huge advertising on Instagram with bright colors and flashy sales. And because of that, your sample market is a specific type of competitor that's probably already right. a little more advanced, been around the block, kind of knows a little bit about what's what. So, you know, I think that's
a total. And I just don't, I mean, I don't post a ton of young bodybuilders. Most of the people I post are middle-aged females. You know, some are younger, but I mean, most good women's physique competitors are 30 and up. I don't work with a ton of national level bodybuilders. You know, these guys in their early 20s are going to the other coaches, which is fine with me.
Well, I know you want to get into that a little bit about the difference between working with males and females. But before we get to that, let me ask you, in your opinion, what types of people should just really flat out, you know, not to rain on their parade, but flat out avoid trying to compete, and why? Do you ever see any red flags that just jump out at you where you almost have to pull someone aside and say, look, you know, this is what's involved. And I've seen somebody with this mindset approach it before and they crash and burn.
I have never told someone they shouldn't compete. Often I'll recommend, let's pick a different show. You know, we need a longer timeline to get into shape. But if someone wants to have the competition experience, that's not really, I don't tell them no, because I mean, we're all coming from such different places and their competition experience and motivations might be completely different from mine. And that, you know, it might be a rewarding experience for them, even if it's not, even if it doesn't result in, you know, a win or whatever. You know, generally speaking, anyone that has physical or mental health issues, you know, maybe that's a red flag. If you've got like a severe metabolic disorder, if you've got an eating disorder, if you're bipolar, like to an extent that it, you know, causes issues in your life, if you're schizophrenic, or if you're not in a stable, solid life situation, you know, if you're going through a divorce or your mom has cancer, that's probably not the best time to start a prep. But other than that, you know, it's your call.
So given the interest in psychology, I mean, do you ever actually get into that with clients? Maybe, you know, people that you've worked with for a more extended period of time, kind of what their personal motivations are and their mindset. Do you actually go over that with people, or you just kind of start with the goals? And
not unless they voice it. You know, I don't think that's any of my business. And a lot of people don't want to talk about that, or, you know, that's, I mean, they hire me to tell them what to eat and what cardio to do. If they need additional motivation, they can let me know and we can discuss that, but it's not something that I bring up regularly anyways.
Do you enjoy it when they do bring it up, or is it kind of more of a burden?
I guess it depends on how they bring it up.
It depends on the person and what.
Yeah, and
what
how nuts they are.
No, but I have to imagine with the amount of people you've worked with and all that, you've probably learned, you know, a decent amount from several of the people you've worked with. You know, I've certainly had people that I prepped and I was really surprised to find out after the prep what got them into it in the first place. And it ended up kind of making, you know, I don't want to say like lifelong friends, but became really close with people. Just because their motivations were so much more radical, or nothing that I would have ever assumed, put it that way.
Right.
So let me ask.
I've developed a lot of really good friendships over the years. I have a lot of clients that I've worked with for many, many years. Usually someone that's been working with you that long too, they just don't have a problem with motivation. Usually if someone has it with motivation, talking to their coach about it is not the first thing they think of doing. They just, you know, they've got something going on in their life, or they're not interested. They're not going to send you a check-in, or they just decide to not do the show or whatever. I just don't think it's common in my experience for someone to be like, I'm struggling with motivation, I'm going to tell my coach about it. I mean, yeah. Sometimes I'll hear about, you know, this week I struggled with this, staying on track. It's more often non-competitors, or people in the off season than people that are getting ready for shows.
Oh, I actually don't know the answer to this. Do you work with any non-competitors, or is it strictly competitors?
I work with a lot of non-competitors also.
Is it more difficult to like toggle back and forth, you know, mentality wise, or is it pretty much just straight ahead? You're going to do the same thing for each individual regardless.
Yeah, I don't really. I mean, the only thing, I mean, every situation is different. You know, everyone's got a different metabolism and different timeline, different goals and et cetera. But I mean, when you're getting ready for a show, obviously you need to get shredded and you have a timeline. So those are the two things that change from a non-competitor. You have to get super fucking lean, and you have to do it by such and such date.
Right.
But other than that, it's not really that different, I guess. I mean, obviously, every prep is different and blah, blah, blah. But in terms of, you know, the overall big picture view, those are the only differences.
So let me ask you this. It's really popular these days to hear that we should, you know, strive for balance. It's become this mantra. Everybody thinks balance is the end goal of their life in all possible fields. Do you think you can be a good competitor and be, you know, quote unquote, balanced? Or is it reasonable in life to intentionally chase not being balanced and seeking extremism? And I'm sure you're going to want a definition of what it is to be balanced, but just using that colloquially as you hear it all the time, can you be a good competitor and lead a balanced life?
Yeah, like you said, balanced is always in the eye of the beholder, and definitions will vary. I would imagine there's as many definitions of balance as there are individuals in the world. But I don't think it makes sense to quote unquote seek imbalance or extremist attitudes. That seems reckless to me. Many won't know exactly what it takes to achieve their goal, so will, you know, potentially do unnecessary things, take unnecessary risks if they just seek imbalance, seek extremism. This is a sport full of young, ego-driven, often uneducated men. So young, ego-driven, uneducated men pursuing extremism and imbalance is not really a recipe for success, in my opinion. But you can't expect to reach the top if you're not willing to sacrifice, quote unquote, a lot of things that normal people do, you know, meals out, missing meals, missing workouts, missing sleep. But the thing is, the guys and gals, the champions, they don't look at that as sacrifice. You know, I've never heard someone that did well in bodybuilding look back and say, oh, I made all these sacrifices. It's just part of the deal they make to reach their goals. They aren't sacrificing anything. It's the regular people that aren't, you know, bodybuilding or pursuing whatever. It's those regular people that are sacrificing stuff. They're sacrificing their potential. They're sacrificing, you know, whatever, glory, the win, by doing basic people shit. So sacrifice, sure, it's just a yin-yang thing.
No, and I agree with that 100%. It's interesting to me that somebody can go in and say professional boxing, where, you know, they're getting hit in the head and, you know, there's going to be repercussions from that, massive repercussions. And the general public, it seems, is a little more accepting of that, presumably because there's so much money tied to it or so much fame tied to it. Whereas in bodybuilding, obviously not nearly the money, not nearly the fame. So much of it comes down to how much risk is it reasonable for somebody to pursue in order to be a champion at, you know, their chosen endeavor. Mm-hmm. And that's what I mean more by the balance component. I don't mean being in balance specifically within the parameters of what we do in our sport, but I mean more broadly in life. In your opinion, what factors, and I know you don't want to tell other people how to live their life, you've made that abundantly clear, but if you were weighing it out, what factors should one weigh realistically when deciding how much they're willing to commit, you know, in pursuit of a specific goal, say for a show? You know, not so much the health component, but does there come a point in your mind where, say, somebody's blowing off social life completely at the age of 22, where you would look at that and possibly cringe a little bit, or is it just live and let live? You know, that's their goal. That's what they're interested in doing, and therefore they're committing themselves completely to that goal.
Yeah, hindsight is always 20/20, right? And I mean, I often look at social media and see guys and gals that are pursuing their goals and just, you know, they've got the blinders on and they're going nuts about it. And I know just from experience, these people are probably not going to get terribly far. Maybe they'll do okay. And maybe that's all their goal was. But that's not for me to judge and say, you know, you shouldn't be doing that. That's for them to learn. You know, we've all got our own journey. But in terms of, you know, where do you draw the line? one person's definition of where you should draw the line might have prevented us from ever knowing who Arnold Schwarzenegger was, or who Ronnie Coleman or Linda Murray was, or who Bill Gates or Steve Jobs was, or who Martin Luther King was. So, you know, I don't know. I'm definitely a live and let live person.
Libertarian of the spirit, so to speak.
Yeah. And I mean, things just don't work out how you think they are. You know, you might say, oh, that's a bad thing. They shouldn't be doing that. And then it turns out to be a good thing. I mean, humans are very judgmental creatures and they love judging others. But I don't think it works out in reality to be a good thing.
No, I agree with all of that. So essentially, you know, there's this, you know, what we call commitment discipline. And then other people are going to say obsession. And there's, you know, a fine line between discipline and obsession. Essentially, what you're saying is you can't really define that line until you look back in retrospect. In other words, if the person succeeded at their goal, they were just being disciplined. If they kind of fell on their face and lost everything because of it, well, maybe it was obsession instead.
Well, you don't even know if that was bad then either. I mean, are you familiar with the sort of Aesop's fable or Buddhist fable, the farmer and his son? His son breaks his leg and everyone's like, oh no, that's so bad that your son broke his leg. And he's like, maybe it's bad, maybe it's good. And then the next day the army comes through, they're conscripting soldiers and they can't take his son to war. So it turns out to be a good thing. And everyone's like, oh, it was a good thing. And the farmer's like, maybe so, maybe not. And then something else happens. It just keeps on going back and forth and like that. And the farmer's like, I don't know if it is a good thing or a bad thing. Mm-hmm. And it keeps on flipping. So we don't, you know, when does hindsight begin? Does hindsight begin right after you fucked up, or 5 years from now when that fuck up turns out to be something that you learn from and are able to use to benefit, you know, yourself and humanity or whatever? For, you know, I mean, there's the timeline is
hard to
define.
The
timeline makes all the difference there. Yeah.
I was going to say hindsight begins when the person puts their post up on social media, casting negative pearls of wisdom on whoever it is they're talking about at the moment.
Right.
So why do you think, you know, it really seems even, you know, 20, 30 years ago, it was much more acceptable that in our society, in America at least, where somebody wanted to commit themselves to a cause. You know, I just happened to be watching the movie Contact the other day with my daughter, right? Jodie Foster, they find an alien civilization and somebody has to volunteer, get in this rocket ship and basically blast across the universe, knowing damn well they're probably not coming back. You know, they're probably going to sacrifice their life on this mission. And the interesting thing is, you know, when we look in our history books at all the explorers who went out into the world and everybody that kind of, you know, went into uncharted territories, they were essentially on that same page. It seems like in our society, it's become almost impossible to accept, you know, I would call it extremism, say just singular dedication to a cause. What do you think is making that happen in our society where everyone is supposed to just be kind of this homogenized milquetoast, you know, don't rock the boat? In your opinion, can you identify anything specific that's causing that mentality to take hold so strongly?
I don't know.
No idea.
I have no idea. And I'm not even sure that I've witnessed that either. Cause I think we can, maybe if we thought about it and racked our brains, we can think of just as many examples of the opposite. So I'm not sure I completely agree with that as being a phenomenon that's dominating right now.
Okay. So then let's get into then specifically why it is that you enjoy working with females more than males in the sport, or if you do in fact enjoy working with females more than males. To you, what are the major differences between prepping a male and prepping a female psychologically?
The biggest thing, and this is generally speaking, but it's mostly true, is women have less of an ego about it. Men, especially those driven to compete, almost always have bigger egos about it than females. And I just don't have much interest in spending most of my time dealing with guys with big egos.
So specifically, how does that manifest? Like, you tell somebody they're just not where they need to be conditioning wise. Men have a hard time accepting that.
Yeah, like they just don't. They don't trust that I can get them where they need to be. They're, you know, they question things. Women, you tell them what to do, and you know, a few days later, you get a report. I did it. This is the results. A lot of guys, competitors, question. You know, why are we doing this? Why are we doing that? Why are we not using this? Why are we using this? I think that's. I mean, that's not just bodybuilding. I think that's probably a widespread thing.
The old truism that a female will stop and ask for directions, whereas a male will drive endlessly lost.
Right, right. There's probably an evolutionary adaptation at cause there.
Well, I was going to say, do you think that that's more biologically inherent or culturally learned or a combination of the two?
Everything's always a combination of the two, but it's probably mostly biological and maybe a little, you know, a bit perpetuated or strengthened culturally, socially.
So obviously, you know, you've seen differences with males and females. What, in your opinion, is the major difference between American competitors and competitors from other countries, if anything?
Americans are dicks.
Okay. And I'm inclined to agree with you without even knowing your reasons, but let's go ahead and hear your reasons. Go ahead and unpack that for us.
Well, it's a generalization. There's a lot of Americans that are great. I love Americans. I love America. it's just, you know, my experience dealing with other countries, they're not quite as soft as Americans. I think Americans are kind of soft on a lot of things these days. And there's probably a variety of causes for that. But I think Americans are a little bit softer. And I think other countries, maybe there's a little bit, depending on the country, of course, there's maybe a little bit less of a draw to social media. But other than that, I'm not sure that I've seen any, you know, broad differences.
You know, one thing that you said, the difference between males and females, the ego thing, the ability to kind of hear the truth or hear what needs to be heard. At least personally, like working with British clients, it's always kind of refreshing to me just because everything is so straightforward, to the point, you know, not a ton of pop in circumstance, if you will. And same with my former training partner who was Ukrainian. You know, you tell him something to his face and it's as straightforward as could be. No pleasantries, no blowing smoke up your butt. Have you found at all that when you're working with individuals from less wealthy countries or even, you know, in America, but less wealthy, they are a little more driven and tolerant to being pushed?
Yeah, that kind of goes back to what I said about Americans being soft. You know, other countries maybe aren't as soft. I've worked with a lot of British competitors. And they are, in my experience, very humble people, and definitely hard workers. I've worked with a lot of Australians, and Australians are just like the nicest people in the world. They're my favorite clients. I have not worked with any Australian that I haven't loved, and that goes for males as well as females, and competitors as well as non-competitors. Now, those are two first world countries, you know, Australia and England are definitely first world countries. I haven't really worked with any country that I would consider not a first world country. You know, I've worked with a couple poorer countries, but not, you know, I mean, you're just not going to get a bodybuilder looking for an expensive coach in a country that doesn't have much money.
Sure. Right. They can't afford to eat. They're probably not hiring you for prep.
Right.
Do you find that the ego thing for males is lesser in a country like England, Australia, or you can't really tell a difference?
It might be a little bit. I don't I don't know if I've got a big enough sample size to speak on that. Well, a little bit, yeah.
All right, so let me talk to you a second about your own prep. You know, you're officially retired now, correct? From competing, at least.
Yes.
During the years that you were competing, we talked a little bit about how as people age, they naturally tend to mellow a little bit. How did your own mindset and your own psychology, as best you can assess it objectively, change over the years when you were going into prep? Did you notice with yourself that there was a lessening in intensity over time? And did it make prep more difficult for you or less enjoyable for you as you know, with each year that passed? Or was it pretty much you just were the same person over the years?
Over time, I learned to know what to expect in a prep, you know, both mentally and physically. So it wasn't as much of a surprise to me as it was the first prep or two. I don't think that made it less enjoyable or less intense, just different, because I kind of knew where I was going, what I was getting myself into. And I would say the same is true for people I've worked with over the years. That doesn't mean it gets easy, but you just kind of know what to expect.
Did you have any kind of tricks that you developed over the years that would help you get through those stages that were more difficult?
I learned, well, one, knowing that it's going to end, knowing that it sucks right now, but this is just, a moment in time and it's going to get better, definitely helps. A lot of the shittiness of prep is chemically related. Maybe all of the shittiness in life in general is chemically related. You know, we were talking about neurotransmitters, serotonin, sure, dopamine, et cetera. So, you know, learning different chemicals to use, different supplements to use that could help me get through when I was feeling like shit, or just different practices. Green tea raises dopamine. And so if you're feeling terrible, have a cup of green tea. And that will help raise dopamine. Diet soda has whatever that PK thing is, phenylketonurics or whatever.
Phenyl keto. So, yeah, I know you're talking about.
Yeah. That's another one that can also pick you up when you're dragging ass real hard. You know, taking a nap, just learning little things like that, that you might not know about your first prep, can help you get through tougher times later. So there wasn't not really any like cognitive tricks or anything other than, yeah, it sucks. It sucks for your competitors too. Who's going to give up first? You or the guy that you're going to be on stage next to, like that type of thing.
Sure. And kind of related to that, you know, we've talked a little bit about how so much has changed in the last, you know, 10, 15 years with social media landscape and all that. As a top coach, you obviously need to stay fairly up to date what's going on in the industry, at least enough to, you know, keep one foot in that realm. How do you manage to stay positive and ignore all the ridiculous drama that's going on in the industry on a daily basis? I know I myself look to a lot of your posts just for general wisdom and insight as a very good means of kind of centering your thought process on a given topic. Have you had to make a conscious push in that direction or intentionally try to focus on the more positive things, given that there's just a lot of, you know, ego, as you noted, a lot of muck in our industry? How do you stay on the positive side of all that over the years?
I think I've been fortunate that I was ever a person that made a lot of negative posts or got caught up in much gossip or anything like that. And just, I mean, all you have to do is go on Facebook and look at posts, bullshit posts or whatever, and look at cause and effect. What, you know, this negative post, or maybe it's, I mean, people don't make a post with the, like, knowing that it's negative. people don't think they're making negative posts, but they are. And then you just look and say, what is the response to this post? What is the general, how do people respond to this post? Is that the type of response that I want to get from people that are looking at my social media posts? I mean, it's really, you're running a business if you're a coach. Would you hire, would you purchase from a company that was constantly bad-mouthing other companies or constantly making negative remarks or, pointing out flaws, whatever? Model yourself after the coaches that you, or not even necessarily coaches, but individuals, companies, whatever, that you say, hey, that's someone I want to emulate. And I just never saw any value or positive repercussions of getting drawn into the negative stuff. Sometimes I would try to make a positive post and someone else would turn it into a negative.
Yeah. Right. Do you ever find yourself, reading online, whether it's a old school forum or modern day social media, where some topic gets put up and you almost start responding and then just have to edit yourself and say, it's just not worth the energy investment. It's just going to go in a bad direction.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Or sometimes you have a really witty response and you're like,
it's painful to sit on those and store them.
Yeah. This is good for at least 30 likes, but fuck it. It's good enough. I'm going to have to bank that one and chalk it up. Have you ever heard the concept of a minimum effective dose?
Yes, absolutely.
So that's sort of, that's sort of a trend I'm trying to make in social media, not just with posting, but with just use, scrolling, et cetera. Use as little social media as possible to achieve your intended effect.
Right.
If you're a coach, I don't really think you need to post a ton of stuff. Post your transformations, post your client picks, post some useful information. Some helpful information, some positive motivational stuff. But other than that, there's no need for you to be, constantly on social media all the time. I see that as a liability rather than an asset.
Right.
And if you find yourself, usually if you find yourself scrolling on social media, if you're scrolling, you're probably just wasting your time. You're probably putting off doing something that's actually valuable.
Sure.
So if you find yourself scrolling, just stop and go do something different. go read a classic, go reply to your client email, go read a book, go listen to a valuable podcast, whatever. But social media, I'm kind of an in and out,
right.
When it's time, go make your positive contribution, your advertisement or, some tips and tricks, whatever, and then get out.
Well, but that also, I think that speaks to the specific type of clientele that you're trying to attract, meaning, the crux of social media to a degree is the more content, the better, just dump everything you can, edit it or not, quality or not. And through the sheer numbers game, you're going to get a certain response with that. But the question is, what kind of response? You're probably right. Looking for a specific type of person who's a little more thought out, a little more serious, not just looking to jump on whatever witticism gets dropped their way.
Right. Right. There's a lot of times I think to myself, if someone is having a negative response to something that I've done, or if something that I do turns them off from hiring me, good, because right. That's not the person I want. Perfect. That's a nice filter that I've set up because I didn't want to work with them in the first place.
Sure.
I don't need that headache or whatever. And of course, another thing to mention is that different social media platforms are different. Instagram is different from Facebook, is different from Twitter, is different from Snapchat. Like some of them are more, some of them can suck in more negative comments and just, you know, just turn into shitstorms and whatnot. I see that a lot more on Facebook than I do on Instagram. So kind of choose your poison, or, you know.
So you might.
I'm on both Facebook and Instagram, but maybe certain things are better for one platform than another.
Right. You mentioned there that if you're scrolling, you're wasting time, go do something productive, read a classic, etc. And you had recently put up a post, you know, name the book that influenced you the most. I'm going to turn it on you for a second. What books do you think it would be wise for people who compete or are looking to get involved with competition to consider reading, whether you're talking greater tomes, you mentioned Buddhism, or specific just life management books? Have you found any philosophical, psychological, behavior management books that you think are just really good eye openers for anyone who's involved in our sport?
The first two that come to mind would be Stephen Pressfield's two most recent, or Stephen Pressfield is an author that has written a lot of fiction, but he has two classics that have come out within the last, I don't know, 5 or 8 years. One is called The War of Art. The War of Art, and then the second one is called Turning. And those
Can you say that again, Shelby? What was the second one?
Turning Pro.
Okay, thanks. You broke up a little.
The War of Art and Turning Pro by Stephen Pressfield. And both of those are just amazing books, worth rereading multiple times for anyone that's preparing any sort of creative endeavor or like a contest prep, anything like that. And Turning Pro, actually, the War of Art came out and I read it and I loved it. And then in 2012, I was prepping to get ready for Masters Nationals. That's the show that I ended up turning pro at. And Stephen Pressfield came out with a book while I was in prep. I was like 3 or 4 months out, and it's called Turning Pro. And I knew that this show was my only chance at turning pro. And I was like, oh my God, like, am I allowed to buy it? Like, what sort of auspicious, creepy thing is this? And he's obviously not talking about pro bodybuilders, but the general gist sentiment is very similar. And I bought it and I read it and I loved it. And it helped me a lot get through that prep. And then it ended up manifesting itself, turning true.
What's the gist?
I can't do it justice right now without having something backed up. It's just about fighting your inner personal psychology and getting shit done. Okay. Yeah, that's the best way to put it. But it's extremely well written. He's a guy in his 70s with a ton of experience. Has written a lot of books about war.
I was going to say, I'm assuming the War of Art is a play on Art of War by Lao Tzu.
Right. Just both are amazing books. And then there's another book called Mastery. I think the author is George
Robert Lennon. Robert. Oh, it's not Robert Greene.
No, it's not Robert Greene. He has a book.
I have his Mastery book staring at me on my shelf right now.
Yeah, not Robert Greene. No, this is another book called Mastery by, I just said his name, George Leonard or Leonard, something like that. Robert Greene, are you familiar with Ryan Holiday?
I don't think, no, I'm not.
Ryan Holiday was his intern for a long time. And Ryan Holiday is really hot right now. He's an author that's got a handful of books out that are very good on stoicism. And things of that nature. But he was Robert Greene's right-hand man, his intern, and assistant for a long time. I have trouble reading some of Robert Greene's books because they're so dry. But I've watched some seminars or speeches with him, and he comes across a little bit better in the speeches. So anyways, those are my recommendations. If you're a competitor, you cannot do yourself wrong by reading Stephen Pressfield, The War of Art and Turning Pro. If you know how to read, those are good books to check out.
All right, Shelby, so not a psychological question, but given that you're retired now, what are your own personal goals in terms of training and fitness, say, for the next 10 and 20 years? What are we going to see coming from your camp?
I don't know.
Don't know?
I don't know. If you asked me 10 years ago, what would I be doing? I would not have guessed exactly this. You know, I'm not someone that really sets long-term goals because life has never worked out for me like that. A lot of great things have happened to me, and I've been able to quote unquote accomplish a lot of cool things, but they aren't necessarily things that I initially set out to or said, this is my long-term goal. I just kind of take it day by day, you know, see what things present themselves, do my best, you know, give my best, learn as much as I can. And that's more my approach to life. So 10 years, I have no idea what's going to happen. I'm sure I will still be, well, I can't even say sure, but I'll probably still be coaching. Probably not quite as much, you know, scaling back a bit on coaching, but I mean, I love it. And I get a lot out of it, so I'm sure I'll still be doing it in some capacity. But any details, I just have no idea.
Given that you're no longer looking to move up the ladder with size and compete and all that, do you find you're still as motivated day to day when you're going into the gym and training, or is it harder to flip that switch?
I don't flip the switch anymore. Well, for me, I was thinking about retiring at least 5 years ago, and it's just been like, okay, one more year. And then, okay, let's experiment and try this and this, and okay, now this is finally going to be my last year. So I've been thinking about it and planning on it for a long time. I didn't start competing myself until I was 28. So I competed from when I was 28 until I was 39. And now I don't train for size. I still like training somewhat traditional hypertrophy training, but if anything, I'm trying to get smaller now. I'm not trying to get bigger. I'm very close to what my stage weight was. My composition has changed because my hormonal environment is different now. But I just train 3 days a week. I do a push-pull leg split. I train pretty hard, but it's not, you know, I mean, if I used to train at a 9 out of 10 or whatever, or a 10 out of 10, now is maybe, you know, 8, 8.5, something like that. My goals now are just totally different. I'm not stepping on stage. I'm not trying to get bigger. I'm not trying to get better in that respect. I'm trying to maintain some muscle. I'm trying to be healthy. I mean, health and longevity are the biggest things for me right now. So I do cardio every morning. I train with weights 3 days a week. And right now, one day a week, I go and do some high intensity intervals on the spin bike. But for me now, it's just stay light, stay lean. I mean, there's not really any cosmetic. I just don't want my face to be fat.
Right.
yeah. And just, well, my diet is very healthy, as much as possible, I try to keep it low calorie. I'm not genetically predisposed to be a skinny or lean person. So just, you know, maintaining a decent body fat is, takes work for me. So I'm a very low carb eater. I eat tons of fruit and vegetables and moderate amount of protein and some healthy fats. But yeah, I'm no longer trying to build a sports car. I've got a Toyota Camry now, and I want to see how many miles I can get on it.
Hey, Shelby, just something I was thinking about offhand here. Since you're not as locked in like you were before, I know that you used to really enjoy travel a lot. And I think that with the competition lifestyle and everything, that kind of made it harder to do. Do you have any future plans or anything that you might consider doing in the next, couple years or so, somewhere you'd like to go?
Nothing solid. I'll definitely be traveling more in the future, but I'm not going to be like the person that's like on some year long, traveling the globe type thing, because I do, and I don't know how much chicken or egg scenario this is, but did bodybuilding make me become more of a regimented person that likes routine, or was the fact that I am a regimented person that likes routine allowed me to be a good bodybuilder?
Sure.
But I have traveled quite a bit in the past. I don't see myself doing a ton of traveling in the future, but I probably will make like one trip a year or something like that. It's taking me a while to phase out of the routine nature of bodybuilding in terms of like meal frequency, especially meal frequency. I mean, your body just gets locked into that. It's hard to go to like eating two or three meals a day for me anyways.
Is that where you're at now, these days?
No, I eat like five meals a day. But I kind of do, it's sort of like intermittent fasting. I don't eat until about noon. I get up at like 7 and I don't eat till noon. But then I have like five meals, but they're all pretty small, maybe 35 to 40 grams of protein each, some fruit and vegetables, and maybe 10 to 15 grams of fat. So it's not a lot of calories, but I can only do that so long. And then I'm like, the leptin, ghrelin, whatever. And then I've got to eat a whole bunch of carbs or whatever. But it's going to take me a little bit of time to get out of. I'm like 6 months post show now, and I'm definitely have made some good changes in getting away from, the bodybuilding lifestyle or habits or whatever. But it's just going to take a while to get out of it more. So I don't see myself doing any like big long trip, over 5 days or something to somewhere real far any sooner than, maybe end of this year into next year. There's something that, more like, going to Southeast Asia or going to South America or whatever for a week or longer or something like that. Yeah. I eventually want to do that, but it's not going to happen any sooner than that.
All right, and then Shelby, I'm going to hit you with this one last one. You mentioned that, your own body composition is starting to change now a little bit, technically, quote unquote, for the worse, because there's a different hormonal environment. A lot of people who compete, obviously, are really driven by having a certain image, having a certain body type. And then when they step away, obviously, really struggle to kind of return to normalcy or some degree of normalcy. Are you finding it all challenging as your body is kind of becoming more, quote unquote, mortal, just how it was before you really pushed the envelope to go pro? Are you struggling with that at all? And how are you coping with that? Or is it coming pretty easy given that you had planned this retirement so far in advance?
It's definitely coming easy, but there's a handful of factors, things going on here. I'm not one of those guys that was a pro that looked like a cartoon character. I'm a guy that was lucky to even get a pro card that looks fairly average in clothes. I'm not a balloon animal. I'm not Akeem Williams or even a Michael Liberatore or anything like that. I don't have freakish body parts. I mean, the only freakish body parts I had were striated glutes, and you don't see those in a 7-Eleven,
right?
Or whatever. So I'm just not a naturally big person. I'm roughly the same weight now that I was when I was competing. And honestly, I probably don't look all that different in clothes. You know, you'd have to see me with my shirt off to see that, you know, delts are starting to deflate, traps are starting to deflate, this and that. And I just, I don't, even when I was competing, I don't think, I mean, maybe some people will probably listen to this and roll their eyes, but I don't think I ever did it for any like massively vain reasons. Like vanity wasn't a big thing for me. I wasn't the type of person that wanted to walk around in a tank top. I don't train, you know, I always stay covered up when I train. It was always a very personal thing for me. So stepping away from that is not hard for me at all, because I didn't have much of my identity or ego wrapped up in it. I have ego and identity, just like everyone, but they're wrapped up in other things, not necessarily a hyper muscular physique.
Very cool. Scott, anything else?
I don't think so. I've just enjoyed sitting here listening to this, and Shelby, I've known you for a long time, but I feel like I've learned some more today. This is really cool.
Excellent. Thanks for having me, guys.
Absolutely. Thank you for coming on. Shelby, why don't you tell everybody, I'm sure most people know, but where they can get a hold of you if they're interested in contest prep or to follow any of the other endeavors you have going on.
My website's just my name, ShelbyStarnes.com. And then I'm on Instagram. I think it's ShelbyStarnes100, 100, 100. And then I'm on Facebook too.
Very cool. Shelby, thank you so much for coming on. We appreciate your time. And everybody else, this has been another episode of Beyond Driven Radio. We will be back soon enough with our next guest. I believe we're having Brad Rowe on next. Beyond that, peace out.
Hey guys, thank you for listening to Beyond Driven, part of the Advices Radio Network. And don't forget, we got a whole lot of other podcasts too. It's a lot of information, a lot of content. It's all free to you. Seriously, the more you listen, the more you will learn. So be sure that you subscribe to Advices Radio at iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. Check us out at advicesradio.com and check out our social media for details on upcoming shows. Thank you. Your support means a lot, and we are happy to be giving back to the bodybuilding community. Team Warrior Within, founded by David and Nikki Johnston. More than 14 years experience as full-time trainers and coaches. Through their online coaching service, they can help anybody who has a passion to make progress. From everyday people just looking to lose weight, build muscle, trim up, to contest prep for beginners, all the way to working with top-level IFBB pros. 100% month-to-month rates, no contracts. Check out the website, teamwarriorwithin.com. And visit Facebook, Team Warrior Within.
Hey guys, this is John Meadows.
And this is Scott Stevenson.
I invite everybody to come out to our seminar, Bodybuilding Fact and Fiction.
Thursday, March 1st at the Doubletree Suites in downtown Columbus. Just before the Arnold Classic festivities, come on in and meet John Meadows, IFBB Pro, the Mountain Dog himself, and Dr. Scott Stevenson. Stay all day from 9 a.m. to noon, then after lunch, 1 o'clock till 4. Starting out with an a.m. pancake breakfast, then all-day lectures. Q&A as time permits, plus best bar ever, and pre-workout from Granite Supplement Speed Force to get you on your way to the gym. For more information, go to drscottstevenson.com. That's drscottstevenson.com. And hope to see you guys there.
Advices Radio.